Welcome one, welcome all. Thanks for joining us today. This is Town Call, a brand new approach to homegrown radio where you are the star, you are the talent, and you will drive the talking points of the day. If you'd like to participate in today's forum, give us a call or shoot us a text, 844-967-2789. It is Thursday. Class is in session. We are joined by Professor John Shelton for office hours today as we dive into the history of Labor Day. But before we get started on that conversation, gentlemen, how are we doing this Thursday afternoon?
Good. It's one of those weird weeks, Will, where because of Labor Day, everything's a little condensed. So it feels like it's supposed to be relaxing because there's only 4 days to work, but everybody's running around trying to get everything done on a short schedule. So it's a good week, but a hectic week at the same time.
I concur. Good week, but a hectic week.
As Aaron and I have been scrambling around most of the morning, and again, Will just rolls out of bed and boom, look. He's in his studio because that's his easy access right there.
Although, for those of you watching on the stream, you can see there's a couch behind Luke. And every few days, I definitely spend 10, 20 minutes just laying on the couch.
I was going to say, well-earned couch break that Aaron does here in the studio in the mornings. And we've got a new producer. He's going to be our morning producer, Sam Davison, helping to alleviate here around the Civic Media headquarters so Aaron won't have to take so many couch breaks as well.
I look forward to it.
Nice. Maybe he can have 8 hours for rest and 8 hours for what we will.
That's what we're trying for, Professor Shelton. It's a growing expansion here at Civic Media, and we're excited to add the team members to help continue to be able to provide the excellent service that we're doing here at Civic Media, while also accounting for all of our excellent production staff's outside of work schedules as well.
Nice. Can I say something real quick about this week that we're having, the 4-day work week? Doesn't it feel right to have a 4-day work week? Like, isn't that something that maybe we could just do every week?
I don't get why this isn't a regular thing at this point, but, you know.
Regularly plan for it, I'm all in favor for it. I would probably prefer the extra day of the weekend on a Friday than a Monday, but, you know, I'm not going to be picky, I guess. If it would had to be a Monday, sure, I'll make it work. I just got
to
plan.
This guy will do whatever he can to get away from headlines of the week with me. He knows. He's scared. He's coming in scared this week.
Although the thing about it being a Friday or a Monday, at that point it wouldn't matter because society would start to change around it. Like, it only matters because right now Friday is the end of the week.
Look at that. The insight from Mr. Aaron Zommers right there.
And we're done. We're off air.
Great office hour session today, everybody.
Somebody pulled the plug. Oh, no. speaking of this 4-day work week that we are experiencing, we wanted to have an excellent conversation last week with you, Professor Shelton, on the aspect of labor and the current events around it and just discussing its history when it came to the National Labor Review Board's decisions surrounding some major changes to what happens when it comes to companies recognizing a union. But we want to take a farther dive back now. Rather than just what's in the headlines with Labor, we wanted to have a discussion about the history of Labor Day, talk a little bit how we as a country got to this place, and what we can learn from the past to help influence the future, say a 4-day work week, if that were to be something that we could embrace here in the United States.
Yeah, so this is a super fun conversation, you know, and you know, we have so many holidays in this country and we don't often think about what they mean. But, you know, holidays they've been set up for a reason, right? Whether it's Martin Luther King Day in January, which helps us to, you know, kind of commemorate the civil rights movement and King's call for, you know, racial and economic justice, actually, or whether it's the 4th of July, where we honor the ideals of our nation's founding. Labor Day is one of those holidays, right? And it comes out of a very specific historical time. And I'm sure, you know, like a lot of your listeners out there, you know, you spent Labor Day enjoying the day off, giving yourself a 4-day week, barbecues, maybe having a few beers. I don't want to make any assumptions about people living in Wisconsin, but You know, it's in many ways, I explained this to a friend of mine, Labor Day is kind of like my Christmas, you know, because as a labor activist, this is the day when we really focus on workers and focus on work. And it's something that we should be focusing a lot more on for people who, you know, listen to this segment every week. They won't be surprised by that. But the history of Labor Day goes back very, very deep into our nation's past. The first kind of Labor Day that was celebrated was in New York City in 1882, and wasn't a federal holiday for about another 12 years when I'm pretty sure it was, this tells you what kind of historian I am. I focus on working people, not presidents necessarily.
It was Grover Cleveland,
thank you, that signed that into law in one of his non-consecutive terms, the second one. So it wasn't a federal holiday yet, but it was pretty organic. It came out of workers in New York City who were organized in unions, obviously, engaging in a, you know, marching in a big labor parade. And that parade was about, it built on other traditions of parades in a lot of American cities. And you know, there had been other workers who, you know, marched before, obviously, before that. But the idea was to take up public space and to demonstrate the power through physical space, the literal physical space of workers in the city, right? When you have this, you know, huge throng of working people organized marching through the city, what better way to kind of demonstrate the power that working people have when they stand together? And so in New York, it became an annual tradition. And then again, 12 years later, it became a federal law. And it's important to recognize what was going on in the country at the time, right? Oftentimes we refer to the period we're living in right now as the second Gilded Age, which makes us aware of the fact that there was probably a first Gilded Age, right? You don't typically have
that
sequels about, about the first one, right? So the original Gilded Age, you know, starts in 1870s, 1880s, and it's very similar in terms of political economy to the kind of, you know, state of affairs that we have now, in which you have a few individual people, many of them, almost all of them, actually white men, who are acquiring massive fortunes on the backs of working people. So, you know, today's Elon Musk's and Jeff Bezos's were in the 1880s and 90s, John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, these wealthy men who built empires with millions and millions of dollars, which would be the equivalent of billions today. And many of them did that by breaking unions. I mean, Carnegie, the steel company that he owned, like literally broke the union in 1892, and that played an enormous role in the amount of wealth he was able to acquire. So, like in many ways, this was the central problem. I argue this to my students, and they're probably tired of hearing it, but it's true. The central problem in American politics from about the 1830s until the 1930s New Deal was how people were going to work, what their conditions were going to look like, and workers were organizing to try and stop the excessive power of corporations and these wealthy individuals to control their lives and to fight for. And I threw this line out there earlier, but the fight of workers in the 1880s was 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will, meaning that their lives weren't going to be entirely consumed by their employment. And it was very common in Carnegie Steelworks, for example, for workers to work 10, 12 hour days, to work 60 hour weeks, that was just expected of them, and to make incredibly low wages. So the
work to live, you don't live to work.
Exactly. And so the efforts of workers to organize were central in Labor Day. This isn't just about celebrating the work that people do, it's about celebrating organizing as a fundamental principle of American life.
Folks, you're listening to Office Hours with Professor John Shellen here on Town Call. If you have a question for the professor, would like to contribute to our conversation about the history of Labor Day, we want to hear from you. 844-967-2789. Will, you had something to add there?
Yeah, I really liked, Professor, how you pointed out the use of how the parade kind of served as an occupation of physical space to demonstrate the collective power. It's a perfect representation of what we say today regarding organizing, because a phrase I like to use all the time is, you know, we, the working class, are never going to out-influence the ultra-elite. We're not going to be able to out-fundraise them, out-spend them, but we can out-organize them because we outnumber them 1,000,000 to 1. And that is these marches was quite literally the a physical representation of our collective power in the sense that look how many of us there are, look how much space we take up, look what we could accomplish if we are standing together as they quite literally march through the city together.
Yeah, 100%. I would add one thing to that though, Will, which is that it's not just our numbers, right? It is our numbers that matters, but it's also the fact that, and this is really important when we think about Labor Day, it's the fact that we actually do all the work that makes everything function, right? Mm-hmm. Like there is nothing happens in this country without labor. And, you know, even though we've seen, you know, we have all kinds of technologies that have taken away some of the kind of work that people have done, you know, in the past, made things easier for people in some ways, and in some ways added more demands on workers. Nothing happens. Jeff Bezos is not a billionaire without the work of all of those people who work in the warehouses, who drive those trucks, who do even the corporate management, like all of those. Jeff Bezos is not doing the work to make his corporation function every day. It's all of us.
All wealth is the product of labor, John Locke.
Yeah, 100%. And so that's a big part of this that we have to remember is it's about the actual function of what we do that matters a lot, right? Like I always tell my students this, employers are not hiring you out of the goodness of their hearts because they want you to have a salary. They're doing it because they can't have their businesses don't function without your work. And the second that you recognize that and you recognize that if all of us stand together, that their business doesn't work, that's when we win. And up here in Green Bay, the Pier area, I'm really proud of the local Teamsters Union, Local 662, that just won a strike over healthcare with New Dairy Select. And they proved that. And they were outside in physical space. I walked on those picket lines with them. They were showing the value, the essential value of what they do to that company. And they won because they stood together and they said, this isn't going to function without us. And it couldn't.
And we saw it not only there in the Green Bay area, but the Lining Kugels workers striking in Chippewa Falls. The seeing the contracts that can be won for those workers when they do authorize and stop their labor through strike, what happens and the results of those efforts. We are speaking with Professor John Shelton, discussing the history of why we're all only working 4 days this week. Well, not all of us, because there were still plenty of people working on Labor Day. And so having this conversation about the past, where we got, how we got to where we are today. And I would like to have a little bit of a discussion on how we could possibly continue forward in the labor movements as well. But if you've got questions for the professor, we want to hear them here on Town Call, 844-967-2789. Download the Civic Media app, take us with you on the go, and you can engage with Town Call right from the app as well. We're going to continue the conversation when we return.
Tricked and robbed to the peasant in Guatemala in a sweatshop got your job and she can't feed her family on the pennies that she makes. Meanwhile, the crime rate's rising up and down the Great Lakes states.
Welcome one, welcome all, welcome back. This is Town Call, a brand new approach to homegrown radio. If you'd like to participate in today's forum, give us a call or shoot us a text, 844-967-2789. Class is in session. We are joined by Professor John Shelton for office hours, and we are covering the history of Labor Day today. Professor, before the break, we were discussing some of the strikes in recent times and the concessions that workers have been able to win back from their employers. Could you dive into some of the past examples as well that have shown the impact that the workers can have when they are able to stand at a united front?
Yeah, well, you know, we were talking right before the show started about International Workers' Day, which is May 1st. And in most European countries, their equivalent of Labor Day is May Day. Which stems from events that happened in the United States, and it's kind of an irony. that, you know, we celebrate Labor Day when a lot of other countries take the example of a very radical movement in the United States as their example of International Workers' Day. 1886, there was a concerted effort in multiple cities that year to get an 8-hour workday in March, April, and May. It was led by a lot of socialists and anarchists, depending on the city. But in Chicago, probably some of your listeners know about this. There was this sort of famous incident stemming from a strike at the McCormick Reaper Works, where workers were, you know, kind of in a public space, and somebody threw a bomb, killing a bunch of policemen. Probably was an anarchist, although it's unclear who actually threw it. And that led to this significant police repression. Those workers were fighting for, you know, an 8-hour workday. Well, there was a similar movement in Milwaukee, actually, and probably some folks in Wisconsin know about this. But workers really in April, May 1886 shut down the entire city of Milwaukee, more or less. And the governor, Jeremiah Rusk, sent in the militia to fire on strikers at Bayview. There's a monument there to memorialize it, and the Wisconsin Labor History Society does an annual commemoration, which I've spoken at before. And so 7 workers were killed, and then there was a significant wave of repression. But the reason I'm talking about this is because it actually did lead to something very meaningful. Sort of coming out of that, workers redoubled their efforts, and there's sort of this moment where out of the ashes of that, workers come together, and you have a push for socialism in Milwaukee, worker power in Milwaukee, that leads to a wave of socialist mayors. I mean, you can actually kind of draw a direct line from the ashes of that fight in 1886 to the wave of socialist mayors in Milwaukee. I don't know if y'all know this, but socialists were the mayor of Milwaukee was socialist from about 1910 until 1960, with only a couple years of exceptions. And Emil Seidel was elected in 1910. And Milwaukee was known across the country for being at the forefront of supporting workers' rights and unions and municipal socialism, like good parks and public water and these kinds of things. So that's a real example, I mean, where workers organize, and maybe it takes a little while, but they ultimately end up, kind of building power. There's lots of other examples we could kind of talk about, but the quintessential example really is like the 1930s, of course, when you have a presidential administration, the FDR administration, that's trying to get the country out of the Depression, and a president that, as our good friend Harvey Kay points out, was really predisposed to kind of support the idea of workers having more rights as a way to essentially save American democracy. And so 1934, I mean, you have strikes across the country. In San Francisco, there's a general strike. There's a huge Teamster strike in Minneapolis. There's a textile strike that is all up and down the East Coast. Kohler workers, right? There's a really important history there. Kohler workers are on strike in 1934. And FDR comes to Wisconsin in 1934, gives a speech at Bay Beach. I probably learned about this from my buddy Harvey, but I teach this to my students now, this speech, where basically comes to Green Bay and right at on the heels of the Kohler strike says, basically sides with the workers and says that the Kohler Corporation is un-American, more or less. And so all that stuff gets pushed into this movement for workers legislation, the National Labor Relations Act, that gives us the National Labor Relations Board, that gives workers the really expectation. There's some other legislation involved later, but gives workers the expectation of an 8-hour workday and at fair pay and industrial democracy. And that all comes from the organizing that those workers did, right? I mean, it's not like, you know, Democrats in Congress in the 1930s just said, yeah, let's give workers the right to organize. That'll be a good thing to do. Not that they didn't, a lot of them believe it, but it took pushing from those workers. And so there's lots of other examples I could point to in the years since, but the 30s are really the kind of quintessential example of how organizing leads to dramatic changes and dramatic changes for the better.
And you mentioned all of those strikes in the 1930s, 1934 around the nation that helped lead to that. We are seeing a resurgence of that here in
hot labor
recent
summer,
years.
Baby.
The hot labor summer, as we discussed last week. but over the last couple of years here, we've seen John Deere strike. We saw Leinenkugel's workers here in Wisconsin strike. The Hollywood is striking right now. The Writers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild are both striking. There's been strikes all over the nation. Do you believe that this is a prime time then that we could see a resurgence in federal labor standards being improved for workers around the country? Or do you believe that we're seeing too much partisanship to be able to see the what was influencing Congress and the president in the 1930s not have the same effect and influence today?
Yeah, that's a tremendously good question, Luke. And that is the question, actually, right? So on the one hand, you know, you are seeing workers take a stand across this country. You know, you mentioned all those strikes. I mean, the other thing to mention is the UAW may very well go on strike. I mean, their president is essentially saying that, you know, the automakers who are trying to just give them essentially a pittance of a raise when, you know, workers are being crushed by inflation and they've had a labor force that has been broken into two tiers, right? So new workers actually make less for the same work as people who have been there for a really long time. And that's a conscious strategy. You know, he's basically saying, Sean Fain is his name. He's basically saying, we have to get a fair contract because this is about the entire working class and about this question of whether we're going to allow people who are raking in, you know, millions and billions of dollars in profits are going to continue to squeeze us. And he's right about that. And so the militants that you're seeing everywhere from Hollywood to the auto industry, this is only going to continue.
Well, it's even more. It's Starbucks. It's Amazon. It's the pilots authorizing strike. Like there is, it is everywhere. And so to see it at the ground level of the workers being able to authorize the strikes and to be able to go to those means to say we are going to exercise our right as workers to withhold our labor, but it's not, in my opinion, being reflected in the federal representation. We saw there was agreement to stop the rail strike last year.
Yep.
And so do you believe that there is a difference between what we saw in the 1930s and what we're experiencing today?
Yes.
Well, and if I may add something too, John, I'm really glad you mentioned the UAW strike because I was going to bring that up as well. Some of the quotes from Sean Fain are excellent. Our intent is not to strike. Our intent is to get a fair agreement. But as we get down to the wire here, there's three companies to bargain with and 10 days left to do it. I know what it looks like. We are fed up living in a country where corporations violate labor rights and there's little to no consequence for their action. Look at what's going right now across the country. Thousands of Starbucks workers voted to organize and the company refuses to bargain. We're facing the same thing right now. He's noting that this is not just his union that he's facing, right? He's mentioning Starbucks as another group of workers that are facing the same thing. These massive corporations are unwilling to bargain with their workers who, as you noted earlier, are the ones who are generating all of the wealth for the company.
Exactly. Yeah. And I appreciate both you and Luke keeping me on task here in terms of the question. And the question is a very important one, right? So we've got all this militants. Where I get frustrated is because I don't think enough Democrats, some get it, but I don't think enough of them understand that the future of democracy in this country and the future, frankly, of you know, whether we're actually going to uphold the ideals of what it means to be an American, rest with creating a strong labor movement. And so you have all these workers who want to you know, build power. I mean, Starbucks and Amazon are the quintessential examples. And we have a labor law that's just completely outdated. And what I would like to see from Democrats is a laser focus on enabling workers to organize and collectively bargain, not staying neutral, right? In the 1930s, there was a series of, I'm trying to think who it was. I think it was the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, that put this out. It had a poster of FDR basically saying, I want you, it's like the military recruiting posters, I want you to join a union. That is what we need to see from Democrats. Every worker in this country needs to see that Democrats from Biden on down to state level office holders want them to join a union, want them to build power at the expense of their employer in order
the
to
the message
make them
of work. Government leadership siding with you, the worker, instead of the corporations would be so it's so different to what we as Americans are accustomed to over the past 20, 30 years of neoliberalism that, I mean, that would be incredibly, incredibly powerful statement. You noted as well, John, from your piece, the percentage of workers represented by unions exploded from just over 10% in 1929 to 35% by the early 1950s. This is not a coincidence.
No, not at all. And, you know, there's legislation that we absolutely have to pass. Some of your listeners probably know about this, the Protect the Right to Organize Act, the PRO Act, which is a piece of legislation that Democrats have been supporting in Congress. It would do a number of things to level the playing field between workers and employers. It would ban things like captive audience meetings, where employers can basically just bring in workers and make them listen to hours and hours of anti-union propaganda. It would force corporations like Starbucks that are refusing to bargain to bargain, and a lot of other things too. We need legislation like that, and Democrats have supported it, but we need more than that. That needs to be the number one priority. And imagine if Joe Biden had said, you know what, we need the PRO Act so bad, I'm calling on workers in this country to occupy the mall, the National Mall, right outside of Congress until we get this law passed. Imagine a president doing that, right? That might actually move the needle and go beyond these like parliamentary games that Republicans play in Congress. I mean, the filibuster should be gone. It should have been gone a long time ago. But the, you know, these things that actually prevent us from getting the legislation we need for a fair economy and a robust democracy in this country.
Folks, you're listening to Office Hours with Professor John Shelton here on Town Call. If you've got a question for the professor, we want to hear it. 844-967-2789. Let's head over to the phone lines. We got Mark from Prairie du Sac calling in. Mark, what's your question for the professor on this Thursday afternoon?
Yeah, how do we end the policy of using prison labor? You know, as an example, Robin Vosch uses prison labor for, you know, his factory. And I mean, it traces all the way back to the Civil War. Apparently, in the South, it was their industrialization. Their factory owners there were trying to employ prison slave labor to run their factories, and that we have that here. And it impacts, you know, salaries as far as workers are concerned. When you're able to use, you know, incarcerated labor to, you know, work in your factories at pennies on the dollar to produce your product, rather than actually having to hire workers at a living wage in your factories, that and perhaps that's a stretch, but I mean that it is just an abuse of labor to use prison labor, as far as I'm concerned.
Appreciate the phone call, Mark. Professor Shelton, your thoughts on Mark's question there?
Yeah, I mean the obvious thing to do would be to pay incarcerated people. First of all, we've got to incarcerate less people, but pay incarcerated people minimum wage at least. You know, that's one step in the right direction. If we have time after the break, there's a whole long history that I can talk more about here. But, you know, the easy answer is pay people what they deserve to make.
There we go, folks. We are joined by Professor Shelton on this Thursday afternoon. If you've got a question or want to share your thoughts, 844-967-2789, Town Call. It's going to be right back.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night.
Welcome, one, welcome all, welcome back. This is Town Call, a brand new approach to homegrown radio. If you'd like to participate in today's forum, give us a call or shoot us a text, 844-967-2789. Class is in session today. We are joined by Professor John Shelton for Office Hours, talking the history of Labor Day. And Professor, something we discuss frequently on the show is how so many of society's issues today are intertwined. We had an excellent question before the break discussing prison labor and that impact on not just the over-incarceration of American citizens, but how their labor directly impacts some of these industries involved. Would you care to touch on that a little bit more in depth?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank Mark for the question. It's a great question. You know, organized workers have been pushing back against convict labor since the 19th century. One of the earliest labor organizations in this country, at least, you know, sort of like national organization, is called the Knights of Labor. And in their like kind of statement of principles platform from the 1870s, convict labor, abolishing convict labor was a big part of what they were pushing for. And they understood it much the way Marx did, right? Which was, it's not just immoral, it also undercuts the wages that other workers get, right? So, you know, this is absolutely something that we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about how it is that we're incarcerating people for so many things and reducing that. But again, like, just because somebody's incarcerated, why does that mean they don't deserve to get wages, right? And the other, you know, and the other thing is, like, in terms of the incarceration, a lot of times you have folks who they're in private prisons, or there's contracts with outside vendors that jack up the prices on everything from phone calls to ramen noodles. Just because somebody's incarcerated doesn't mean they don't deserve fair wages. They're still doing the same work as anybody else. And if you really are serious about rehabilitating them, pay them while they're in prison so that they can actually come out with some money saved up and have a better shot at being rehabilitated into society.
But it is mm-hmm. abundantly clear that American prisons have no focus on rehabilitation whatsoever.
Yeah. No, it's about revenge.
That's a longer conversation for another edition of Town Call. Yeah. But discussing the history of Labor Day, the labor movement here in America, and as you've noted, the slogan, the rallying cry for a lot of the 1800s, early 1900s, was 8 hours for work, 8 hours for leisure, and 8 hours for rest. And so that applied to an 8-hour work day. Now we are seeing, as we kicked off the show, discussing the potential for a 4-day work week instead of a 5-day work week. Professor, what can you share with us about where the labor movement is heading and how trends like a 4-day work week, like we're experiencing right now, could become more common here in the U.S.?
So one really crucial thing about 8 hours, 8 hours, 8 hours, right? The crucial thing about that was an 8-hour workday came with the assumption that workers would not be paid less, that they would get paid the same amount for an 8-hour workday that they were getting paid for 10. And so any conversation that we're going to have about a 32-hour work week needs to be connected to the fact that people are not going to lose their wages because they're working a shorter work week. Well, we should decide as a society, and there's a great book that came out a few years ago by John Nichols and Robert McChesney called People Get Ready. It's an argument for a jobless future. And what they argue is that, you know, we have all this technology. We should be using that not to enrich billionaires, but to reduce the amount of work that people don't want to do, right? And so a 32-hour work week could be a step in that direction. I mean, imagine if you had an extra day each week, you know, to spend time with family, to pursue a hobby, to learn a language, you know, to write poetry. I mean, who cares? You know, like
I would say, go to the doctor if we could afford that. But there are other opportunities too, yeah, that day to day life that you can't take advantage of during the work week unless you take off of work anyways.
Right. Right. I mean, and even beyond that, Will, you could learn a little bit about fantasy football so you don't get crushed. I mean,
oh, dude, unnecessary.
Oh, that will okay. We might have to work that into our Thursday conversations with the professor as well.
John's getting an invite to my league next year, so I can show him a thing or two.
We
now
got a reigning champion in our midst. John letting us know during one of the commercial breaks that he won one of the leagues he was in last year. So,
But all joking aside, my team name last year was called Woke Mob, by the way, which I think was a great nickname. Was a great name. You know, like in all seriousness, we should be thinking about using the fruits of all that we've produced as a society to enable people to have better lives. Right. And so we should absolutely be thinking about a 32-hour work week. Unions have pushed for this in the past. There was kind of wasn't a super serious movement, but there was a movement in like the 1960s, you know, to start rethinking some of those things. And I think there's been some union leaders recently who have talked. I think it might have even been Sean Fain who talked about the possibility of a 32-hour work week. These are things that we should absolutely be thinking about. Like, the only reason that we're continuing to have a 40-hour work week is because it allows our bosses to squeeze more out of us. And that's because that's just how things have always been done, at least since the 1930s, when we got the 40-hour work week with the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938. Maybe it's time we rethink that metric. I mean, that's been, what, like almost 80 years ago now. Over 80 years.
I was going to say, almost 90 years ago now. Yeah. Next year, it'll be 90 years already. So there's some time passed in between those two. And I think the important part is having these conversations. The first graph, anytime they're thinking about adjusting a 32-hour work week becoming the more standard, is the graph of worker productivity versus wages
that,
over the last since the 1930s, since like the 1960s and 70s, we've seen productivity skyrocket, and still
as technology has advanced, because right. individual employees are able to accomplish so much more, but rather than being able to, you know, take the additional accomplishments and then save time on the back end, they're just being forced to spend more time and produce more and more and more and more.
Exactly. So it's important to have these conversations. We really appreciate you, Professor Shelton, for joining us on this Thursday edition of Town Call. If you miss any portion of the podcast, you're going to definitely want to check it out on Civic Media's website. And looking forward to continuing the conversations on these Thursday afternoons. I apologize that school is back in session, full swing for you. I am in complete denial that summer is gone. I was in the rain last night playing volleyball still. So in my opinion, it's still summer, but I know that you've got the classes to continue to teach, so we really appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us here on Town Call. Will, we got headlines of the week coming up tomorrow. Any other big fun things we got cooking here on Town Call?
Well, we got fantasy football this weekend, but I've been catching strays for that every time I mention that, so I might have to start not referring to that.
Well, you brought it up so frequently, I figured you'd want to talk about it more. That's all. I was worried that you weren't getting your due. So if we bring it up, it's totally okay.
I'll always talk about it. I'm more than happy to talk about it.
Well, but I'm going to get access to the team, and I'm going to make a bunch of changes, so just to let you know.
Okay, well, I guess you won't be getting access then anymore.
Oh, okay. Oh, then I can just plead ignorance when it
team
comes to
town
last place.
Team Town Ball-In doesn't necessarily need you this year.
Just ball-in solo. Just not the full duo. Just there you go, running off on your own. Folks, Town Call will be back tomorrow at 12:15. Talk to y'all then.
Take it easy, party people.